This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. In this week's news, we discuss the erosion of manual piloting skills, pickle fork cracks on the Boeing 737NG, the European Commission review of Boeing's plan to take controlling interest of Embraer's commercial business, a helicopter crash close to home, an MCAS-like system on the KC-46 tanker, tracking stealth fighters with passive radar, Delta's proposed stake in LATAM, and also Delta's change to its rules for emotional support animals. Also, the EAA and the Academy of Model Aeronautics unveiled a new Young Eagles Build and Fly program, and we have the exciting results of the 2019 AOPA You Can Fly Challenge. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 572 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight on the East Coast, and joining me from the West Coast is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's a CFI of the year and an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft. Hi, Max.
Max, hello. Nice to be here with you this evening, along with the rest of the crew.
That's right. We do have a good crew here. With us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian. Hi, David.
And helicopter geek. Hi, everyone. This is going to be an interesting experiment. Max and I have been playing with the new toy for the last couple of weeks, and this is the introduction to this week to the big show. So we'll see how well this turns out.
That's right. We're not using Skype at all. We're using something called Squadcast for those of you who have your own podcasts or do recordings like this, and hopefully we'll get through it and everything will be okay. But to help us out with this show is our main man, Micah.
Hello, everyone, and Shona Tova, or Happy New Year. It's been a crazy day. It's 5780, and I've been writing 5779 on my checks all day.
Okay.
No, I think it's 2019 AD. What year are you in?
I'm in the Jewish New Year.
Oh, there we go.
Very good. All right. Well, the guest we had planned for this episode was unable to make it, so it's the four of us, and we're going to focus on the aviation news from the past week. Why don't we jump right in? Is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready from Philadelphia.
And all set up here in the Northeast.
The first item comes from the EAA. EAA creating hands-on build and fly RC model building and flying program. Max T, what's this all about?
Well, this is, I think, a great relationship between two organizations that care a lot about the future of aviation. One is EAA, Experimental Aircraft Association, and the other is the AMA, Academy of Model Aeronautics. And, of course, EAA has been around for more than, I guess, 60 years, helping to encourage pilots who fly experimental aircraft, otherwise known as homebuilt aircraft. AMA, which I know a couple of us are members of, has been focusing mainly on RC flying, so model aircraft, and more recently on drone aircraft. And so both organizations have put together a new program called Young Eagles Build and Fly Program to, as they say, engage youth in hands-on building and flying of radio-controlled aircraft, which I think is really great. I have certainly run into some folks when I'm teaching flying who have started at an early age, with model aircraft. So basically what they're doing is they're providing local EAA chapters, of which there are many scattered around the country, the opportunity to buy a kit for about $500, which has several model aircraft and, radio-controlled transmitters, stuff like that, and just encouraging them to partner with local AMA clubs to create a build project and a learn to fly program for interested youth. And the funny part is it includes, they say, a particular model of aircraft, the SIG LT-40E cadet kit. I didn't know what that was, even though I've been a RC flyer for about 5 years here. I did a search on it a couple of days ago, and lo and behold, every time I go on Instagram now, it asks me if I want to buy one.
Figures. Now, there are some sponsors and some companies involved in this, I understand, that are helping to lower the cost to those who are participating in this than if they had gone out on their own and purchased the, you know, the kits and the equipment and so forth.
Yes, the Burger Fund and discounts from SIG Manufacturing and Horizon Hobby. So the latter two are manufacturers of some of the kits that are included in this $500 purchase. So pretty cool program. And by the way, one of the models is one of the classic kind of balsa builds. You know, these days when people buy, you know, off-the-shelf RC airplanes, a lot of them are just foam and they go together really fast. But, you know, this is one of those classic, you know, put all the individual ribs together, each of the little die cut pieces and glue it up and so on. So this will not be a 1 hour activity. It should be fun to, you know, get a lot of people involved putting it together.
The only way you really learn how an airplane flies.
Yeah.
I mean, you need to know what spars and stringers are and how they affect flight. I recommend everybody learning to build a balsa wood kit because it's fun. Unfortunately, you just don't get the added benefits of the dope that we used to get when we smattered it on the fabric, which made you feel really good for a couple hours afterwards. But if you were in an unwell ventilated room, but SIG makes a good product. Horizon does really, really nice radio equipment. And it's another good way to get EAA and AMA working together in its STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So, you know, learning all of those structures to build an aircraft that you actually get to see fly, and hopefully you don't get to see what I usually do with radio control airplanes, and that's crash them.
Now, has it changed very much since I was building them as a kid? Because all I remember is hours and hours of sanding on balsa wood models, and it just took forever, and I would get discouraged. Is it the same kind of thing, or are they made of different things now?
You know, and that's what I was going to mention is the real trade-off of the balsa wood models is you spend hours building them, and when they crash, you've got basically, you know, kindling, you know, when you're done. I have crashed a number of my, you know, foamies, and man, you can glue them back together in an hour or so in many cases. So the foam was a lot more resilient to crashes. The balsa wood, man, you know, a lot of that stuff is just completely destroyed when you crash. So yes, the foam goes together faster and it, you know, survives the crashes better.
All right. And you can learn more details. There's a website for this, eaa.org/build-and-fly. And you can also look for more information at the EAA and AMA headquarters. All right. Micah, why don't you take the next story?
Well, the next story is it ends up being a 737 MAX story. You just can't get away from them. And the FAA is urging the ICAO, which is the International Civil Aviation Organization, to address the erosion of manual piloting skills. And it turns out that the FAA is very concerned about the training shortcomings and a concept that they're calling automation dependency. And they're talking about that at ICAO's 40th assembly has taken place in Montreal. And the concern has been around for years, but it was brought about by the 737 MAX crashes. And the FAA is really concerned that pilots may have lost or perhaps never really attained adequate manual flying skills because they've come to rely on increasingly complex automation systems designed largely to prevent pilot error in the first place. So they're going through a bunch of different recommendations with that. And I'm curious, Max, as the pilot here in the group, what are your feelings about that?
Oh, I think it's a real issue. I would say that there are probably, you know, small pockets of you know, airline pilots who, you know, may not get much time on the controls. My wife's cousin, who flies for one of the majors here in the U.S., said he always just loves flying it, you know, by hand all the way to 10,000 feet just to get that experience. Though he said a lot of his colleagues, you know, they'll snap on the autopilot at the minimum engagement altitude, which is going to be, you know, a few hundred feet above the ground. So yeah, it's definitely a real issue. I would say it's probably less of an issue perhaps for airline pilots than it is for, you know, some of the folks who are flying some of the fancy smaller airplanes. Because yeah, I would say that, you know, the airline pilots tend to have, you know, more hours and more skills. But yeah, it's certainly an issue. It can be an issue for, you know, any pilot at any level of experience.
We had the opportunity, Max Flight and I, to spend some time with the airline pilot guy, Jeff Nielsen, who expressed some concerns about automation taking over, and actually mentioned that some airlines are requiring pilots to fly in automatic pilot and have the airplane fly themselves, and are discouraging hand flying more and more.
Yeah, and certainly a lot of the, some of the more sophisticated aircraft that I fly, there is a lot of training that, you know, basically involves turning on the autopilot, fairly early. So, yeah, it's that's common, I think, both in the big planes and some of the more sophisticated small planes.
Well, the report is that the FAA was going to raise this issue at the ICAO assembly meeting, which is ongoing as we record this. It's in Montreal. Is running from September 24th through October 4th. And there are some daily bulletins that are available on the website. And for the first few days, I kept looking at the bulletins to see if there was a report of the FAA, in fact, bringing this up. But it hadn't happened as I was looking through the bulletins. Maybe it has now, or maybe it will. And we'll put a link in the show notes if you're interested in kind of diving into what's happening at this assembly. It's you've really got to want to know what's going on to sort of wade through some of the daily bulletins. But it's a significant issue, and the FAA is basically saying that they think that the ICAO standards and guidance need to evolve as automation evolves and continues to expand. So the FAA is saying, in effect, I think, maybe in different words, that the world is changing, and so the standards need to change as well. We'll certainly be watching to see what comes of this, if anything.
So every third Airbus and every third 737 will effectively go back to having steam gauges. That way, they're going to hand fly them.
Even those airplanes can have autopilot, so it's more about the autopilot than it is about the type of gauges or panel you have in the airplane.
Well, one of the things they're talking about
take all my fun out of you being realistic there, Max.
All right, Mr. Helicopter.
One of the things I think that's important that they're addressing is that they're raising concerns about the fast track that the ICAO has put for with a commercial pilot license that's known as the multi-crew pilot license. And that's what you see. I think you see it mostly in Europe, but that license requires no minimum cockpit hours, that those holders of it only have to have 240 hours of simulator or cockpit time with a private pilot license. And those are for the multi-crew pilots that, fly in the middle of a mission, from once the pilot takes off, it's, the third officer or the fourth officer, the second crew. And I think that's something that the FAA was concerned about here.
Wow. Yeah, I guess I wasn't aware of that. But certainly the in-between part where you're leveling crews, I would say that, someone with very little, actual time in the cockpit could probably manage that pretty well. But, what happens when something goes wrong? Yeah, it's easy to think of Air France, 447, where, they're in the middle of the Atlantic and suddenly, find themselves in a thunderstorm. You kind of still want someone pretty experienced when you encounter those kinds of things. But yes, 99.99%. Some of the time it's on autopilot, pretty boring. You're talking on the radio, and that's not going to require the same level of skill.
All right. Well, there's some good news, some great news out of AOPA. Max T, why don't you take this one?
Well, way back in episode 550, back in April this year, we had on Jennifer Storm. Jennifer is vice president of the AOPA Foundation, who oversees all the aspects of the foundation, including raising money for the foundation. And so she talked about some of the many programs they have, including the You Can Fly program and the matching grant, the challenge grant that was being offered by the Ray Foundation. And I think she mentioned back then that it was a $2 million grant, so they would match up to the first $2 million of contribution through August 31st of this year to the You Can Fly program, which is just a portion of what the AOPA Foundation does. Well, Jennifer and her team there did a great job of soliciting donors, and they blew past that $2 million milestone, and the Ray Foundation voted to increase its match all the way up to $2.5 million. So collectively, they raised between the foundation and generous donors $5.3 million. Now, the You Can Fly program has a number of different aspects to it, some of which are, you know, promoting flying clubs, others of which are helping rusty pilots get back into the air, and also working with the high school students in various programs. So it's a pretty comprehensive program to try and encourage flying at all levels. And I think this is probably a record-breaking year for them. So hats off to Jennifer and her team there at AOPA Foundation. Job well done.
Yeah, over 5,000 individual donors, which is just spectacular.
Wow, with those kind of numbers, they could make the next debate for the Democratic National.
Oh, gee. I'm not even going to touch that. So instead, let's talk about 737s again.
Let's talk about a different 737 this time, though, Max.
Yes. Which one is this, Micah?
Oh, it's the NG, the next generation. The old ones, the ones that are still flying. That's the scary part.
And apparently some of these have cracks in a particular component that's known as pickle forks, which I think is great. You know, from my days at Pratt, it's just so common for, I don't know, I guess the engineers or even the manufacturing people to give names to components that describe what they look like. And in this case, the aircraft has something that kind of looks like a pickle fork. And as I understand it, it's a structure that connects the wing and the fuselage. And the wings can actually flex in flight, probably no surprise to those listening to this show. And the pickle forks kind of, manage the load and transmits it to the fuselage. Reportedly, they're meant to last a lifetime, but they've found a couple of them that have some cracks.
Yeah, that could be a little bit of a problem, don't you think?
Yeah, I think the engineers that have been quoted in these articles will say that if one of these fails, that's a catastrophic failure. But they're just not ever expected to fail.
Well, I always worry when somebody say it's going to last a lifetime. It's like, well, whose lifetime? You know, lifetime with the plane or the people that go down with the airplane when something fails.
You mean when they fail it somehow, they're in a pickle?
Yeah, exactly. And who uses pickle forks anymore, by the way? That's the thing I want to know.
Yeah, really.
Max, just to put an analogy back, this is no different than the 130 wing structure joint that we talked about less than a month ago that the Air Force grounded everything just because it was, if it failed, it would be catastrophic. So,
right.
I mean, this is not one of... I think we need to couch this in the fact that this is really not a failure of Boeing, considering these NG aircraft now are probably minimum 10 years old, 10 or 15 years old. So, I mean, it's something that would be developed over time or with age. I mean, wing spars, especially heavily used aircraft, are eventually going to fail. So, I mean, this is not in the same league as the 737 MAX. I mean,
no.
This is an age and structural issue.
But the what they said is that the plane is relatively young, and they've only logged about 35,000 flight cycles, and that's when the damage was found. And there was a Boeing engineer who wanted to remain anonymous, said it's unusual to have a crack in the pickle fork, and it's not designed to crack that way at all.
I'm curious to see how this is handled in the press and what the public reaction is, because cracks in parts sounds really dramatic, certainly to anybody that's, you know, not familiar with metallurgy and, you know, how these things work. I mean, cracks are fairly common in different components, and some they're not at all, but what you do with it, how you handle the situation, a lot of times you just drill a small hole at each end of the crack, and that stops the propagation. I can recall, I won't say how many years ago, a lot of years ago, sitting in the window seat of a 727 over the wing, looking out at the wing skin and noticing
all these little holes everywhere in the skin. They were cracks that had the, you know, the ends drilled, and that was the end of it. Now, I'm not sure that that's what's going to happen here with the pickle forks, but I guess my point is that, yeah, they need to be a little careful about getting too concerned, too excited about this until we know more.
Yeah, you're talking about the technique called stop drilling. So I think every mechanic is taught to put a little hole at the end of a crack. And if you ever watch those cracks, it does stop them for a while, but invariably keeps cracking, you know, through the far end of that hole. At least that's what I've seen.
Yeah, and what the engineer has said is that the crack in the pickle fork is like, you know, when you see a crack in a coffee cup handle, and, you know, you can keep using it, but eventually it's going to fail.
Yeah, or it may. When it does, it's yeah. You're going to have hot coffee in your lap. So we'll see. Next item. This comes from the Wall Street Journal. Boeing and Embraer deal faces EU scrutiny. And Mike, I guess the EC, the European Commission, they want to take a look at that plan for Boeing to take controlling interest of Embraer's commercial business.
Yeah, you know, and they're making comparisons between Boeing taking a controlling interest in Embraer's all commercial part of it, and they're comparing it to Airbus and the C-Series, and some people are saying, you know, well, why is that happening? And I think that's kind of an interesting, it's a bad comparison, because Airbus took control of just the C-Series, as opposed to Boeing taking control of all of Embraer's commercial products. And it's just another thing that's being looked into again. And I take it maybe in retaliation to Boeing saying that Airbus was purchasing the C-Series and didn't want that to happen.
This, of course, is the deal where Boeing would spend $4.2 million and purchase the 80%. Of the Embraer's jetliner business, and a minority stake, I think, in the military cargo jet project. The article states that Boeing has already raised funding for this deal, this proposed deal, through a bond offering. Embraer shareholders and the Brazilian antitrust officials have also given their approval. Meanwhile, the U.S. antitrust officials did not raise any objections to the deal, so it's kind of up on the European Commission right now. It's worth noting that if this transaction fails, if the European Commission says if they can't do it, then Boeing would owe a $100 million break fee. And again, if this transaction fails, which is not chump change for sure.
Pocket change. Yeah, I think at the beginning of the story, you mentioned it was a $4.2 million. It's a $4.2 billion purchase.
Did I say million?
Well, yeah, but
oh, you did. But I was sort of like, okay, well, maybe I'm missing something. But
but it's a huge merger. I mean, it's 80% in Embraer's jetliner, 49% of their military business. And that is a huge merger. It's almost like, you know, what happened when McDonnell Douglas used Boeing's money to buy Boeing, which is now actually McDonnell Douglas under Boeing's name. But it's a huge business, as opposed to, again, Airbus buying licensing pretty much to produce one C-Series.
But really, for all intents and purposes, what else was Bombardier at the time producing?
Bombardier, they still had their buses. They still had their trains. They still had
Airbus didn't purchase any of that.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's kind of your point, Micah, right?
Yes.
Here, Boeing would be purchasing 80% of the commercial business and that smaller portion of the military. So it's a bigger acquisition from the standpoint of the equity holding. All right. Well, we have another story that sort of has a close to home kind of feel for it. This is from the Press Herald in Portland. That's the Portland paper, isn't it, Mike?
Yeah, that's the Portland Press Herald.
And we had a R-44 Robinson crash.
Yeah, right at the Sanford Airport. And when I saw that Robinson, the R-44 crash, a bright red, beautiful helicopter, I said, oh my gosh, is that our friend Ernie Eaton? Because that's the helicopter, that's where he flies out of it. He flies a red helicopter, and I was very concerned and didn't want to message him right away because I was afraid he was getting lots of messages. And if it was indeed him, which it wasn't, you know, I didn't want to be bothering him or his family at the time. But it turns out it wasn't our friend Ernie, but it was, in fact, a helicopter that he and I flew in just a couple of years ago, and the one that he flies regularly.
The pilot, Jack White, 50-year-old, was transported to the hospital after the crash with severe injuries. Do we have any updates on the condition?
No, he's still in critical care, and we don't know very much about him. We do know he was transported by helicopter because the Life Flight helicopter happens to be based down there at Sanford Airport. So that was kind of interesting and ironic and a very good thing. But people saw it crash. He was doing maneuvers. He's working on his helicopter license, and there's a helicopter school down there, and it was the school's helicopter. And it was very concerning when it happened, and we hope that he gets better. But it's the first time that I've personally experienced an actual aircraft that I have flown in be destroyed like that.
Yeah, that's kind of like it has to sort of shake you a little bit. And of course, you spoke with Ernie. It was episode 454. It was a Bits and Pieces episode, and you talked to Ernie at the Hampton Airfield Cafe right after your flight in that R-44.
Yeah, we went and got a $100 hamburger and had a great time. And, you know, and Ernie came down and he visited us. You met him in Chantilly this year.
Yes. All right, back to Boeing. We have a lot of Boeing stories, a lot of 737 stories. This is from Reuters. Boeing omitted safeguards on 737 MAX that were used on military jet. And what we see here is the KC 46 has a system kind of like MCAS. It's not exactly the same, and it was implemented for different reasons. Well, kind of different reasons. I think on the tanker, David, wasn't this because of load shifts would affect the handling of the aircraft? So this MCAS like system compensates for those load shifts.
Right. I mean, tankers are unique in that large amounts of fuel get transferred out of the aircraft and from various parts of the aircraft, and causes balance issues, causes the aircraft to get lighter, causes the aircraft to maybe be heavier on the port side or lighter on the starboard side or towards the front of the. So you have to have some sort of compensation for when you are refueling, say, an F-15, or more to the point, you're refueling something like a B-52. There's going to be differences in the configuration of the aircraft just by the process of refueling. Now, the 767 is, which the KC-46A is based on, it's kind of a apples and oranges sort of comparison to the 737 MAX. The 737 MAX was because they were worried about the increase in power, not necessarily the change in the aerodynamics of the aircraft. So it does configure the aircraft based on its inputs, but that's pretty much where it starts and stops.
Now, there was a significant difference, or there is a significant difference between the 737 MAX system and the KC-46 system, in that the KC-46 system has two angle of attack indicators, whereas the problem we saw with 737 MAX is just one. So I guess the Air Force is kind of watching this being the 737 MAX investigations, just to be sure that there isn't anything that they need to be aware of or learn from when it comes to the tanker.
Well, the other, and I think David said this, the other big difference and the important difference is that when MCAS or whatever the equivalent is takes part in the KC-46, when the pilot touches a control, it disables automatically and the pilot has a control of the aircraft. Whereas with the 737, it doesn't disable when the pilot takes control or adjusts the controls.
So maybe we can just have a little side conversation. We received a number of voicemails from one of our listeners, young Troy. I think his name is Troy. If that's not you, Troy, if I didn't get your name correctly, let us know. But Troy got a little bit agitated that we were spending so much time talking about the 737 MAX. And I started thinking about why we talk about it so much. And I think there are a lot of reasons why we talk about it so much. I don't know. Let me ask you guys to start off with. Micah, why do you think we talk about the 737 MAX so much?
It's a huge story. It's perhaps the biggest airline story that has hit publicly ever, I think. And it's one of those stories where everybody knows something about it. And correct information and incorrect information is going out. And there are so many aspects of it that there are so many different things involved in what's happening with it. Is it the FAA? Is it Boeing? Is it pilots? Is it engineers? Is it certifications? That it's all encompassing. And we experienced this when we'll talk about it later, but we were sitting around the dinner table with some friends, Max, last Wednesday. We got a chance to visit, and some people that had nothing to do with airlines or aircraft or weren't airplane geeks at all were asking questions about the 737 MAX that they would normally never be asking questions about aircraft or handling or why this was going on. And so it's a huge all-encompassing story, and it's critically important to what's happening in airline safety and aviation right now in the worldwide.
I think it's a big story because I think it's just a stunning failure in aeronautical design and probably in kind of corporate, management or coordination among different pieces of a large, complex organization. In some ways, it's kind of reminiscent of the similar issues they had with the space shuttle. The first one that was a Discovery, I guess, where they launched with
Challenger.
You're right. Back in the 80s when that one launched, when the engineers said, nope, you really shouldn't do it. It's pretty cold. And they went and launched anyway. I mean, this just has certain aspects of that story. And I think we all find that a little disconcerting. You know, you like to think that large companies are very good at what they're doing. But I think the reality is the larger the company gets, the more difficult it is to coordinate all the little different bits and pieces, and complex failures like this can crop up in totally unexpected ways. That's kind of disconcerting for us as passengers of airliners. So yeah, I think it's a pretty big story.
And it's the other thing is that it's with a company that is too big to fail. I don't like that phrase, but it's really true. This company is bigger and is more involved nationally in terms of employment and in terms of development and in terms of aerospace than the three car companies combined and in most of the banks. It has its hands in everything. And if it fails, there would be a major, major problem with it. And then when you look at the Swiss cheese model of failures in terms of problems that go on with an aircraft when you investigate accidents, there are so many holes in this story that lined up just exactly so you could look right through it that it's a very frightening situation.
Do you have some thoughts, David?
Well, Troy's not old enough to remember this stuff, but back in the day, there was something called the de Havilland Comet. And the de Havilland Comet, if it was in terms of modern day social media, 24/7 news cycles, would have been as big a catastrophic failure as what we have now with the 737. In fact, there were more people dead because several aircraft decompressed because of the shape of the windows. That would have been a $1 million 24/7. And literally took de Havilland aircraft in Great Britain pretty much out of the game, because that gave time for Boeing to create something called the Dash 80 or the 707. Or you could talk about, there was something called the Lockheed Starfighter, the F-104. And the first couple years Germany got it, they crashed and fatally killed at least 24 pilots before. If that would have been a catastrophic failure due to flying and not understanding the aircraft in training, the biggest difference why we talk about it so much is because it's on the news every night. You turn on CNN and somewhere in that crawl at night will be, it's a 737 MAX story. And the bigger the failure, there's more people looking into it. Once the doors cracked open, it's easier to open it up even wider. I mean, and Boeing has faced a lot of failures, you know, with the KC-46 as another thing, or, you know, and now they are getting hyper scrutinized because everything's fair game because of what's happened. So unfortunately, we're going to be talking about this for a long time. Max creates chapters on this podcast. So if you're sick of hearing about the 737, like I am, or tankers, which I really am, I just suggest fast forwarding it. We touch on lots of things all the time, and we try to get a balance of all aspects. It's just, this is an important company in the industry. It's an important aircraft in the industry. The 737 is the most produced jet airliner, and it's a catastrophic failure, not once, but twice. And it's got lots of aspects. So history says that there will be something else, but Boeing is going to do it. And in a way, part of the problem is Boeing has mishandled the whole process on the other side after the accident. So it's no different than us talking about United every other week or every week. We talk about things over and over again because there's more and more news every week, you know, and we don't ever repeat the stories, I think, is one of those things that we need to say is each week there's something new that comes out of Boeing or Capitol Hill or the FAA. Or, I mean, it's no different than we have FAA stories almost every week on our drone podcast. So, Troy, I hate to tell you this, but one of those things you're going to get used to is the news is the news. And our job is to commentate on it. And we can't pick the news. We only can commentate on it. We don't go out there and make the stories. We just discuss them.
But what we do sometimes is we do spin off new separate podcasts. So I think it's time to announce the 737 MAX Digest. And folks can sign up and subscribe to that separately.
And you're volunteering to take the lead on this?
Oh, no, Max. Mr. Trescott? Oh, no. Max is the one who does that stuff.
So just to add a few things that to what you guys have all said is it's not just a Boeing story, right? It's an FAA story as well. We have the whole issue of the FAA credibility in the issue. Micah mentioned the certification process. We're likely to see some changes in the aircraft certification process. That doesn't affect just the 737 MAX. That's going to have implications for future aircraft, not just commercial, but general aviation aircraft as well. We've got the issue of the regulatory agencies around the world not acting in unison the same way we've seen in the past, where the FAA would typically take the lead in something like this, and all the other regulatory agencies would follow the FAA's lead. But here we're seeing that's not exactly happening, or there are some indications that it hasn't or may not. And so that's an issue. You guys touched on the public relations management aspect of this, and how Boeing is responding from that standpoint, as well as how the FAA is. And then there are also financial implications for Boeing that are significant beyond just the 737 MAX. They're going to spend and have spent and will continue to spend a ton of money on this, on not just compensation for the victims, the families of the victims, but also compensation to the airlines and the internal costs and all of that. And I think that that's going to have a big impact on Boeing. It may impact, I've said in the past, the NMA and whether or not Boeing ends up with enough capital to fund that, or if the timing of that is pushed off so that it doesn't become a priority that Boeing had hoped it would become. And that could affect the next Boeing narrow body or a 737 replacement. So there are a lot of implications here.
And there's also, and I don't know if we brought this up because it was kind of mentioned in the ICAO article with the FAA, but it's talked about, and in that from that article, I'm going to quote it in hushed tones, that there may have been pilot error involved. And that's something that we're not really even discussing because it's politically incorrect to talk about that possibility. But pilot training is a huge issue in this process because MCAS was basically put in based on pilot training, not poor pilot training, but a lack of a need for pilot training. So there are so many topics that are so critical to this story that, Troy, you asked us not to talk about it. What do you get? You get more and more of it.
Yeah. I was just thinking, he's probably sorry now he sent the email. And I think, you know, we should promise not to talk about 737 for the next episode.
Okay. Well, I think maybe for the rest of this episode, but that's as far as it'll go because there's too much going on.
All right. So let's go back to the news. And we have an interesting story. At least I think this is interesting. This is for, let's see, who is this from? C4ISRnet.com. The title is Stealthy No More. A German radar vendor says it tracked the F-35 in 2018 from a pony farm. We'll tell you about the pony farm coming up. But
I think that's another story a little further down.
But this is an issue about active radar versus passive radar. And I think the radar that most people know of or at least think of is active radar. But there's also something called passive radar. And in passive radar, you don't broadcast out radar. Basically, you receive the electromagnetic radiation from, I'll call it, environmental sources, things like radio stations, TV stations, cell phone transmissions. All these things are spewing out electromagnetic radiation. And they bounce off of airplanes and everything else as well. Maybe not as strongly or with the same characteristics as sort of conventional active radar. But there's a German radar maker, Hensoldt, that they have a passive radar system. And they claim to have tracked two F-35s following the 2018 Berlin Air Show in Germany last year. And I guess the system is called TwinVIS. It's TWINVIS. And it's a passive radar system. They set up to try to see if they could detect the F-35s. But for whatever reason, the F-35s were not flown during the air show. So they got this idea, well, the F-35s have to leave the air show when it's over. So they positioned their equipment a little farther out in a pony farm, and they say they were able to track the F-35 stealth fighters. Now, I don't know. Do you think this is a big problem, a big issue? Is it something that everybody needs to be concerned about?
I guess I'm supposed to chime in here, aren't I?
We're looking at you, David.
Okay. The last time we were talking about passive radars was the shoot down over Kosovo of the F-117s. The only F-117 that was shot down over Kosovo. At the time, the Yugoslavs were bragging that it was their radar that caught the F-117. It really was a matter of the fact that the Air Force was a bit stupid, and like it did in Vietnam, it was flying the same patterns at the same time every day. So at exit time, the first F-117 came over, followed by the second F-117, followed by the, let's shoot at that one, third one.
Predictable pattern.
Predictable pattern. We have gone out of our way to avoid using stealth. One of the things that most people don't know is when we fly red flag or we've flown against other countries with the F-35 and the F-22, they put very large things on them that make them radar reflective, because we don't want people to pick up the radar. We've gone out of our way about Turkey with their S-400 anti-aircraft missiles, that they're not getting the F-35 because we don't want to have the F-35 radar being picked up by the S-400 and then transmitted to our potential enemies. This is one of those things that, yes, they caught the F-35s. They were leaving an air show. They were flying a predictable pattern. They were talking to air traffic control, and they had very large radar reflection discs placed on the side of them. So they would show up on radar. Now, in the article, they say, well, that isn't a factor with the passive radar. But that being said, I don't see any occurrence that they've been able to recreate the process. And passive radar is passive radar. It's basically you're finding something that doesn't fit the normal profile. We've been using passive sonar for years and years and years to detect submarines. We have seismophones underwater that just listen. They do not transmit. They just listen. To hear submarines or earthquakes or tsunamis. So it's not new technology, but inevitably it's stealth. It's not foolproof. No one ever says that these things are completely invisible to radar. They are ultra small signals on radar. They're not a billboard. They're more like a tiny little bird or an insect. So they're harder to track, but they're not untrackable. No one's ever said that stealth is perfect. It's a way of diminishing the signature, just like putting in for infrared, you know, where you change the pattern of the exhaust to lower the profile for the heat signatures. You know, if you've noticed military helicopters over the years, they now have exhausts that point upwards. Why do they have exhausts that point upwards? Because it puts the heat in the downwash and cools off because of the giant fan above them. So the ground attack surface-to-air missiles don't have a bigger signature on them. So there are ways to defeat everything. And this is one of those, it's a really non-story with a very big headline. I know Micah is going to disagree with me, but it really is a non-story.
And I don't disagree with you, David. I just, I think what's interesting, it's just a matter of technology development, you know, and we went through Generation 1 jets and we found ways to shoot down the Generation 1 fighters. And then we had the Generation 2 and we found ways to get down the Generation 2. So we went to Generation 3 and now we're on Generation 5. And, you know, we're starting to look at Generation 6. And it's just a matter of eventually we'll find a way. But I think you're completely accurate in what you're saying. This may not be it. But, you know, it's something that we need to be aware of.
It's a cat and mouse game.
It's like what we talk about on Fridays. We've got UAVs and then we've got counter UAVs. And for every counter UAV, we've got a new UAV technology to outwit the counter UAV. So it's the nature of warfare from the beginning of time, since Abel took Cain out with a rock.
Right.
All right. Well, let's look at a airline story. This is from CNBC, Delta is buying 20% of LATAM, America's largest airline. LATAM Airlines, LATAM. That used to be LAN Airlines and LAN Chile and a One World Alliance member. But Delta is looking to take a stake in that operation, Micah.
Yeah, and they outbid. There was a deal going on between LATAM and American, and Delta sort of walked right in there and pulled it off and got 20% of them. And I think that's just amazing. They're really expanding their routes. Delta has expanded its ownership and relationship with so many different international carriers recently. You know, based on rules, you can't really own, or based on international rules, you can't own, you know, a major percentage of one carrier. So it took 20% of LATAM, and in that deal, it gets 14 A350s, which it's been working to get anyway. So just amazing. They now have 20% of LATAM, 9.2% of Korean. They've got some kind of agreement with WestJet, and I think they have 49% of Aeromexico. Right. They're really moving into Latin America now.
Yes, they are. And LATAM will be exiting the One World Alliance. According to the article, there's no word if they're going to join SkyTeam, but with the Delta stake, 20%, I guess you could kind of expect them to do that.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all. Oh, and Delta has recently struck up a deal with Virgin Atlantic too. They've got their code sharing tremendously with Virgin Atlantic. So, yeah, they're a big growing airline. That's for, well, they all are, but Delta seems to be on the move.
And this, of course, is pending regulatory approval both in the United States and in Chile.
Maybe if Delta makes a deal with Boeing, they can own Embraer.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Oh, from from ABC affiliate WMTW, Delta lifts ban on emotional support animals on long flights, but pit bulls are still barred. Oh, the poor pit bulls.
Oh, it always amazes me. You know, I need my emotional support pit bull wherever I go because he protects me from vampires.
Well, Delta has lifted its ban. It had a ban on emotional support animals for flights that were longer than 8 hours. They pulled back on that ban, but that puts them in compliance with the Department of Transportation. But Delta does continue to ban the pit bull breed, even though the Department of Transportation says breed bans are not allowed. According to the DOT guidelines, an airline can deny transport to an animal if, quote, it poses a direct threat to the health and safety of others. Well, that makes sense, but I assume that means it's based on an individual animal, not a whole breed. But pit bulls have a reputation. Delta officials said that pit bulls account for less than 5% of the overall dog population, but now get this, 37.5% of vicious dog attacks.
Whoa.
So Delta says, understanding this risk, Delta has not come to a solution for allowing pit bulls on board that satisfies its own rigorous safety requirements.
Wow. And here I was trying to think maybe my biases against pit bulls in the past were, you know, not warranted, and I should be open-minded and, you know, be more accepting of the breed. I think I'm back to my prior biases. I mean, that's pretty impressive data. So that's for dog bites in general, not on airplanes, but across the board.
I take it to mean, yeah, across the board, vicious dog attacks.
Yikes.
And Delta just experienced a dog attack on a plane from a pit bull just recently that we reported on, I believe. And so I can understand them, you know, being a little hesitant about it. You know, I opened up the transportation.gov, and you have to remember that airlines are not the ADA does not apply to airlines. They are responsible to the Airline Carrier Access Act, which is very, very different. Yeah. And their rules for the airlines are that they can exclude an animal if it's too large or heavy to be accommodated in the cabin, which is why I don't get how the miniature horses work, but I guess they are small enough that pose a direct threat to the health and safety of others. And I could see how that might work in terms of a long distance flight, because over 8 hours, you know, the animal's got to go. What are you going to do with it? You know, there's a health and safety issue. Cause a significant disruption of cabin service. Well, there's another one right there. Or prohibited from entering a foreign country. And so, you know, I think Delta, I think that eventually this will be challenged in court. And the fact is that it's too politically incorrect. That's the second time I've had to use it on that term on this show, but it's too politically incorrect to challenge these things in court, and the airlines don't want to get bad publicity over it, but eventually it's going to have to happen.
Hmm. Yeah. To me, it seemed a little odd that if you accept that it's reasonable to have various kinds of service animals, emotional support animals on aircraft, why wouldn't you let them on more than 8 hours? And I was thinking the same thing, that, you know, eventually they're going to have to go potty. But I think that's true whether they're on the plane for 1 hour, you know, or 8 hours. And that is one of the things that, you know, some of the, you know, airlines have complained about in the past, or certainly the passengers have, which is, you know, it's pretty hard to, you know, prevent these animals from making a mess on the airplane. I think a lot of it just has to do with luck and timing. And certainly part of my luck and timing has been not having to sit next to one of them. But, you know, the day may come when, you know, I'm sitting next to the miniature horse, and hopefully I'll just be petting them, having a good time.
Well, and the fact is, a professional, well-trained service animal that is documented in whatever way it's documented, the animal relieves itself before it goes, and you know that you're going to have a certain amount of time before it needs to go again. But with the emotional support animals, and I put that in quotes, these could be anything for any reason, and you have no idea what they are or why they are or if they really are. So there's no way to tell, and that's the big difference. Mm. And I don't think we have ever had any negative comments about a service animal, but emotional support animals, it's a horse of a different color, is a completely different thing.
All right, what's up with the geeks? Micah, you and I had a great time up in, where were we, Lewiston, Maine?
Lewiston, Auburn, Maine, with the airport. But boy, the past couple of weeks have been just fabulous, because Captain Jeff Nielsen, the airline pilot guy, if you want to listen to another podcast, but you need to have a lot of time to listen to it because they run 3 or more hours. He had 3 layovers in the past 2 weeks. He was here, when was he here? I guess it was 2 weeks ago or so from this recording. He was here on a Wednesday. He came back on a Monday, and he was here the next Wednesday, which was last Wednesday from when we were recording this. And Max, we had already had plans. You were going to come up, and the Collings Foundation was in town. And boy, what a great time that was, wasn't it?
It was fantastic. I'll do the aircraft first, and then we can talk about the people, because that's really the fantastic part. But they had a B-17, a B-24, a B-25, a P-40, which was pretty cool to see the P-40, and a P-51. And there was a Huey helicopter there as well. Was that part of the Collins?
I don't think it was. I don't know.
They were giving some rides. But anyway, this is their Wings of Freedom tour. And we were hoping to try to get a ride on one of the aircraft. But they didn't have enough people sign up that day that we were there. So they were not doing flights. Which was unfortunate, but we did get to crawl around in the bombers and all, and had a great time doing that.
And we arrived as the aircraft were arriving. So we got to see the P-40, which ended up went tech. It had some engine problems, but we got to see it go through the pattern and land. And the same with the B-24 and the B-17 and the B-25, the P-51 was already there. And it was a TP-51, one of very few that were made. It was a trainer built as a 2-seater, which was just amazing. And there was one real problem with that day, by the way. There was one real sad note. That was David wasn't with us.
Yeah. Yeah. We missed David with all that great hardware. But, you know, besides just looking at the airplanes and getting up really close, because you're basically able, you have full access really to these aircraft. But the people that you stumble across during the course of the day, I think that's what really made it for me. Now, Mike and I made a couple of recordings. We interviewed a couple of folks, and we're going to have those in a future episode, probably the Veterans Day episode, or the episode that comes out that week of Veterans Day. But one of the people we ran across, Micah, we ran across a 96-year-old gentleman who was a veteran. He was a tail gunner on the B-17. And we had a great conversation with him. Just fascinating to listen to his stories and his thoughts and recollections. We obviously weren't able to take too much of his time, because at that age, you know, you don't have quite the stamina to put up with a couple of AV geeks and a microphone.
We met General Doolittle's flight surgeon's son while we were up there. We didn't get a chance to interview him. We were just having a conversation, and the idea of bringing out a microphone didn't happen. But General Doolittle's flight surgeon's son was there, and when we were talking to him about all the people that he knew and some of the names that he knew that were written on the B-24 bomber. It's just amazing.
But he has his father's diary, which sounds like it's a pretty detailed account of, you know, all of the goings on, and just a record of history that's probably maybe not like other records we have from that era. But see the man's enthusiasm, but just the emotions that he had over, you know, being able to read through this diary and learn these things. It's just really, really amazing. So it was a great day from that standpoint. But we also met with some other folks for dinner that evening. We had dinner with listener Vernon and his wife Ruth, along with their friends Brian and Carol. And I think I've got all the names right.
You got it. And Captain Jeff was with us too.
So Vernon, when we first saw them at the restaurant, handed me a sheet of paper. It's a typewritten sheet of paper, double sided, both sides. It's like, okay, this is what is this? Well, this is the Vernon that sent us a recording that we played back in episode 241 in 2013. And this is when we had asked people to describe how they got interested in aviation. And this is the transcript from Vernon's recording. And it was just so great to go back and look at it. I mean, Vernon's passion for aviation started many, many, many years ago when he was a 14-year-old kid watching airplanes land and take off at a little local airport. And soon after that, he was offered a free ride. There was a Cessna 182 that was giving a scenic ride to somebody, and they had an open seat. And the pilot or somebody asked if he wanted to go up for a flight, which, of course, he did. And the rest of the story is in that episode. But it was really, really great to meet those folks and have a great dinner, some good food, some good company. And I think that's what these kinds of events are really, really all about.
It was just a great time, and it was so nice to see you again, Max. And the next morning, what happened the next morning? That was also another great story, actually. We went out. We followed the EAT at the airport.
Yes. Go ahead.
We went to the EAT at the airport website, and I've been driving by this little restaurant at the Lymington Airport in Lymington, Maine, for a long time. So, and it just got a great review in the Portland Press Herald. And so we drove up there for breakfast and met with Bunk Chase and his wife, Diana. And had a wonderful time there talking airplanes. Bunk is pretty much a resident of Sun and Fun. And then we got invited back to his hangar to see the most beautiful Piper Cub that I have ever seen in my life.
That man has some really interesting stuff in that hangar. And that Cub is really amazing. Micah explained to me before we walked into the hangar that this yellow Cub wasn't just a yellow Cub. It almost kind of had a glow to it. The paint job was so beautiful. And so we asked Bunk about how he achieved this, you know, great look. And he said part of the trick is putting down a good primer coat of white first and then applying the, you know, the final yellow paint over that. And I asked him, I said, did you put some kind of a clear coat over that to help it, you know, give it that depth and everything? He said, nope, no clear coat at all. Didn't need it. It's just beautiful the way it is. So fantastic aircraft. Yeah. And what a couple too. Great folks. So we'll have some interviews from that event again, like I said, coming up in a future episode. Let's see, Max Trescott. What's going on with you?
Oh, did I have fun last week? I had my first annual recurrent required training in the Vision Jet. So anybody who has a jet type rating has to essentially do it all over again every year. So it's not like flying a piston aircraft where, you get a private pilot's license and then you may get a checkout for a few hours at a new aircraft type. Here, getting the initial training for the Vision Jet was about 9 days. And with a private pilot's license, every 2 years, you might spend a few hours with a flight instructor. But here, if you're type rated, you're going to have to spend a good portion of a day with an examiner redoing all the things you did on the original check ride. So you do the same check ride over every year. So it was great fun. Did the oral discussion in the morning where we're talking about all the different systems in the aircraft. And of course, jets have a lot more systems than the piston aircraft that I'm typically flying. So everything from the pressurization to, the fire protection systems and the anti-icing systems, all that. So it was just kind of fun studying and regurgitating all that knowledge as part of the oral discussion. Then we got to go fly the jet. Now, most of the time when I'm up there, I'm in the right seat and I'm observing and coaching and making suggestions, but I don't get to push the buttons. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about you guys, but I like to push the buttons. So it was fun being in the left seat for a change and being responsible for everything that we did up there. So we spent 2.2 hours and did steep turns and slow flight, three different kinds of stalls, and then four different instrument approaches, a couple of precision instrument approaches, a couple non-precision, including circling to land at a different runway that's different from the one that the approach was flying to. So all I can say was, oh man, what a fun, what a fun day. I did not feel like I was being tested. I felt like I was having a great time. So it was, so for folks that get check ride anxiety, all I can say is, after you've done 8 or 10 of them for different ratings and you're doing these things, it's a lot more enjoyable. So that's, go ahead, Micah.
Let me ask you about that, Max, because you said a couple of things, actually. You said three different kinds of stalls. Mm-hmm. Now, I know there's a power on stall. I know there's a power off stall.
Yeah.
What's the third kind of stall?
Scared to death stall. No, I'm kidding. I believe it's the autopilot induced stall. So essentially we've got the autopilot on and we've got the power a little too low. The aircraft gets slower and slower and slower. And then eventually the autopilot causes the aircraft to stall, except that in the case of the Vision Jet, it's got envelope stability protection. It has ESP. And this is true on the newer SR-20s and SR-22s as well, the piston models. Essentially, if you don't have enough power to stay level and the autopilot would otherwise stall the aircraft, there will come a time when you're a few knots above stall, it will start descending. And so it's, trading altitude for airspeed. So instead of the autopilot keeping you, pulling you up into a stall, it eventually realizes, hey, I can't just keep flying level. I need to go down. Otherwise, this aircraft will stall. So in the case of the Vision Jet, it's got the stick shaker, which shakes rather, strongly to kind of let you know, hey, you're right at the edge of the stall here.
And then the other question I had for you is, as a CFI, CFII, and you're going through this retraining, how much reviewing and studying did you have to do? And how much did you just get in the plane and you knew what was going on?
Oh, very little of the latter, a lot of the former. I mean, certainly, operating the flight planning systems and stuff like, pushing kind of the buttons that, get the airplane flying and keep it flying. That part, knew that pretty much, but it's like, do you really remember exactly, how much power you need to put in for slow flight versus a steep turn versus, there's a lot of review on the maneuvers just so that you're at least in the ballpark. Even if you're not exactly right on power settings, if you're close enough, it's easy to make small adjustments, but you kind of want to know, all right, what are the ballpark settings I need to start out in so that you're not way far off from those. And then the instrument stuff, actually, not too much to study on that because I'm teaching instruments all the time. So for me, the preparation I did on that actually was the night before I went out to a simulator at the local flight school and flew four approaches in it. And it's a good thing I did, because there were two things that I noted while I was doing it where I thought, oh, geez, I'm telling people to do that stuff all the time, and I forgot to do it myself. And having, you know, encountered that the night before made it that much easier the following day to kind of go, okay, don't fall into, you know, that trap. So, yeah, all kinds of preparation, a lot of it book work, but also just getting back in any simulator to fly any instrument approach, you know, helps as well.
And you passed, I assume.
Oh, I forgot to tell you that. Yeah. So it turns out that you can't fail it, but you, you know, they can continue to work with you till you get to the point where you do pass. So it's not quite like the check ride. With a check ride, you know, they're really not supposed to do any training or assisting, but you know, here they're allowed to let you do it again or train you a little bit more if you don't do it right. But yeah, everything, I'm at the standard the first time, so that was good. And then later this week, I'm headed off to the Grand Canyon, which, hard to believe, I've been to all kinds of national parks, but I've never been to the Grand Canyon before. So I'm at
North Rim or South Rim?
Yeah, we're flying into Phoenix, so it'll be down on the South Rim. So you're right, that'll be a future trip to go to the North Rim.
Yeah, because it's a different experience. Anybody else have anything aviation-wise coming up? If not, one quick shout out, following up on Jeff Bolton. You remember our guest from episode 570?
He was great.
We got some really good feedback on Jeff's appearance on the show. This was the guy, of course, who had the videos from inside the B-2 bomber. Well, he's posted, we got a notice, he's posted videos of his filming inside the B-52H Stratofortress bomber cockpit during nuclear mission training and in flight, of course. And he's got some new videos and a post-flight interview that are available at his website. That's jeffbolton.org. So you may want to take a look at that. All right. Well, we want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com for show notes, how to find us on social media, how to subscribe to the podcast. You can learn more about each of us, and you can even make a small donation to help us pay for this show. The direct link to the show notes for this episode is airplanegeeks.com/572. And of course, you can reach us via email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Well, Max Trescott, where can everybody find you online?
Well, they can find me online at aviationnewstalk.com. And this week in Aviation News Talk, we're talking about a topic that doesn't get talked about much in the aviation world, and that is the need for pilots to speak up when they see stuff that's not quite right or when they see people engaging in risky behaviors. And I've got a couple stories to tell where pilots didn't speak up, and it's really, you know, kind of interesting and makes you think about, well, what would I do in that situation? But if you want to shoot me an email, go to aviationnewstalk.com, click on contact at the top of the page, and you can also click on listener question to record a listener question.
Great. And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter if you can spell Vanderhoof. You can find me on Facebook if you spell Vanderhoof. If you really wanted to find me, you can find me on our Slack listener team with all of our other gang that's there. You can do that by sending us a request to geeks@theairplanegeeks.com. And we'll go ahead, either Max or I will send you an invite. And you can join the club behind the top secret door.
And what if I can't spell Vanderhoof? What then?
Well, then Google Airplane Geeks and you'll find a hyperlink.
Okay, very good.
All right. And Micah, how do we find you online?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Maine Fly. That's Maine like the state, M-A-I-N-E Fly, like let's all go flying. And you can reach me at the Airplane Geeks with Micah at airplanegeeks.com. That's Micah, M-I-C-A-H. And of course, I'm also on that Slack listener team, and that's a fun place to hang out.
It sure is. And you can find me there as well. Also on Twitter, occasionally at Max Flight, but you can find me on LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com, and talking about the passenger experience with Mary Kirby at PaxXPodcast.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
See y'all soon.
And thanks for listening.